you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We are still working to independently confirm the information about the vaccinations and what the availability is at Cal State Los Angeles. If you have an appointment, of course, everything's great. The question was about walk-ups, and we've had a number of listeners saying they've been turned away from walk-up vaccination at Cal State Los Angeles, which had been heavily publicized earlier. We hope to have some more details for you right here on KPCC. But we turn our attention now to the recent mass killings that have taken place here in the United States and how news media covers those terrible events. We just had word, of course, earlier this morning that a former NFL player is suspected of killing five people, including a prominent South Carolina doctor and his grandchildren. The former NFL player also is said to have taken his own life. This Philip Adams is the former player. And then, of course, we had the mass killing at a business in the city of Orange here in Southern California that happened just a few days ago. And prior to that, the attacks on three massage parlors in the greater Atlanta area where multiple people were killed. Joining us to talk about how news organizations make the decision on how much time and how they contextualize mass shootings is Kelly McBride, media ethicist and senior vice president of the Poynter Institute, also the public editor for NPR. Kelly, it's so good to have you with us again on Air Talk. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
So one of the things that brings this to the fore is we had this terrible incident close to us here in our listening area in the city of Orange, where we had a man who was seriously injured. He is in custody and hospitalized, in which he is alleged to have killed four people, including a nine-year-old boy. And this garnered national attention once authorities said that this was a case where the alleged gunman knew the individuals. It revolved around a specific business where the gunman had apparently worked, as alleged by authorities at least. This fell off the national media landscape. So I wonder if you can talk a bit, you know, what are the elements that you know, make these terrible events, some rise above others in how they're treated by national media?
Yeah, it's very different when a story like that goes from local to national. The biggest element is fear. And we don't talk about it a lot, but what we all know is that a random attack generates more fear and therefore more compulsive consumption of the story. And so it's not enough. This is actually a very dark commentary on both the news media and the American news consumer, but it's not enough to just have a horrific act where a number of people died. There has to be something more that propels that story forward, because there are many, many stories of people dying. And so the sheer number doesn't always keep it on the national radar. But when you have a story where the attack is random, where the relationship between the attacker and the victims is non-existent or only tenuous, as opposed to what you guys just experienced, which is a case of workplace violence, the national news media doesn't stay on that story very long, because there's no way to convince consumers that this could possibly happen to them, even though it could, right? It's so much easier to tap into the fear and sensationalism when it's a random attack. And also because we've had this spate of mass shootings, this sort of American phenomenon where randomly people will go and shoot up a place, that becomes a self-perpetuating cycle for journalists. They know that people are afraid of these things. So random attacks get even more coverage now than, say, just a workplace shooting. Well, the other attacks that get a lot of coverage are school shootings. And then also, you know, I think that this one with the football player will get a lot of coverage because people will want to know if he had a head injury and want to know more about his post-career life.
And the early reports are that he might have been treated by the physician who he's alleged to have killed. And so there are further questions in that story. And I guess that sort of sets up where I was going next. I mean, it seems to me that much of this is driven by what is the public curiosity. When you've got a case of domestic gun violence or workplace gun violence, most of us, as terrible as this is, understand these things have been happening for generations. We understand that these are terrible events. We can sort of get our heads around more. But when it comes to, you know, someone attacking massage parlors or a school or things that are more random, we have all these questions we want answered. Or in the case of the ex-NFL football player alleged to have carried out this mass shooting today, just the questions you were asking is, you know, had a traumatic brain injuries. What was the relationship with the family where he attacked the physician and his grandkids? So I mean, is it fair to say a lot of this is what's sort of unanswered and that drives the story?
Yes and no. I mean, that's part of it. But the other part of it is that as a citizen, do I feel like I can control these circumstances? And we have this mistaken idea that we can prevent ourselves from getting into a relationship where there might be domestic violence, or we can prevent ourselves from becoming involved in a workplace violence incident. And so we do this thing where we explain that away. We dismiss it as that couldn't happen to me. Whereas if I'm just grocery shopping and somebody decides to shoot up the supermarket, there's nothing I can do. And so, and the thing is that the media organizations tap into that. They almost exploit that fear of the unknown or the uncontrollable. That's where I think we in journalism have a bit of responsibility to look at. If you're in a national news organization, we really do need to question which crime stories we elevate to national coverage, because it's a totally different equation than what a local journalist might decide in terms of covering even a single act of violence as opposed to multiple acts.
So how would you do that with something that is as sadly common as domestic violence in which family members are killed or workplace violence? Because these events are so common, how would you cover that in a way that would make sense without it being just, you know, all carnage in the newscasts?
Yeah, I think if I were the standards editor at CNN or any other national organization that does a lot of coverage of crime stories, I would start to articulate which stories get covered and what the standards are. And I would say them out loud so that the public could see what our standards are. And it would be really hard to say, well, we're only going to cover stories that can strike fear in your heart, because that doesn't seem like journalistically responsible. And so that then would cause you to say, maybe it's the number, maybe it is the drama around who got killed, or maybe it is that that will do stories that you articulate some sort of compelling narrative, right? So the football player might pass that threshold, but articulating what that standard is would be where I would start. And then I would start to look at how many stories do we do? How many resources do we send to the area? How long do we cover it? And try and create some sort of standard where you can account for some of the darker elements that drive us to make decisions that seem random and unfair about the amount of coverage when some tragedy has happened.
We're talking with media ethicist and senior vice president of the Poynter Institute, Kelly McBride, and NPR's public editor, her role as well. Coming up, we'll talk with Perelman School of Medicine assistant professor at University of Pennsylvania, Eleanor Kaufman. We'll talk with her about her research that she's been doing into shootings and how media covers it. We'll get her point of view. That's coming up in just 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. We're talking about how media organizations cover mass shootings, why some make it to national news and are covered even weeks afterwards, and how others just maybe get initially reported and then are no longer deemed to be of national interest. Sometimes they'll continue as a local story. I think the workplace incident in the city of Orange, a prime example of that, where, of course, that's going to continue to be covered here in Southern California because of the four deaths, including a child, how it's devastated a family that operated a business in that commercial building there in Orange. But it's a national news story because the alleged shooter was known to the family members because there was some degree of alleged relationship, it doesn't make it to national news. Joining us to talk about the broader perspective is assistant professor of trauma surgery and firearm injury researcher at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, Dr. Eleanor Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman, thank you very much for being with us. You know, when you look at mass shootings and public perceptions of them, what do you think, perhaps in part or largely due to media coverage, has left the general public in the dark about or confused about when it comes to mass shootings?
Thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for covering this topic, which I think is really important, because as somebody who spends a lot of my time taking care of people who have firearm injuries, and the other part of my time researching how we can prevent those injuries, I think that the way that the public understands what's going on is hugely important to what kind of policies and programs we're going to have in place in our country. And unfortunately, the evidence shows that most people really don't understand sort of the reality of the situation. So these mass shootings that we're talking about today are terrifying. They are shocking. And they are very rare. They're about 1% of the firearm injury deaths that happen in this country every year. I mean, that's too many, of course, but it's far from being the majority of deaths. But in a nationally representative survey from APM from a couple of years ago, about a quarter of Americans believe that mass shootings are the most common form of firearm injury death. So that mismatch, I think, has to do with what people read, what people see on the news. But I think it's really misleading, and it kind of leads us away from developing the prevention strategies that would really be effective.
Yeah. And what are the ways, as you look to media coverage of shootings, that they could better put this in context to better understand? I mean, I just, for example, I know that violence related to gang activity, something that, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s was a huge problem here in Southern California, that it seems like that's a local story, but it doesn't really break through to national coverage, even though the loss of life is collectively staggering.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, You know, I was thinking about it when your other guest was talking about fear being the motivating factor. And it's fear, but it's fear of certain segments of the population. So I think that this coverage tends to be geared primarily toward white Americans who do not live in communities that are affected by the daily gun violence that affects my patients who live in primarily black and brown communities in cities like Philadelphia, where daily community gun violence is a major source of fear and is a reality. Those are not stories that necessarily even make our local news. And when, you know, we looked at that in our local data, about half of victims of firearm injury aren't even reported locally. When my colleagues, led by Dr. Jessica Beard, looked at what we would consider to be a community mass shooting, a neighborhood mass shooting, not necessarily one of these events that's classified as random by the national media or in our national consciousness, but where 4, 5, 6 or more victims are shot at the same time in the same place here in Philadelphia. Only one of those was ever described in the media as a mass shooting. I think that has to do with who, as a society, who we value and whose deaths and injuries are considered shocking versus expected. And unfortunately, I think it doesn't speak well of us.
We're talking with University of Pennsylvania professor, assistant professor of trauma surgery and firearm injury researcher at Penn's School of Medicine, Eleanor Kaufman, joining us on Air Talk. We're looking at how news media covers mass shootings and the degree of context or lack of context that goes into this. Kelly McBride, back to you. What are the ways that you think media can more effectively take into account what Dr. Kaufman's describing?
Well, I wish that media would cover public safety as opposed to covering crime. Because if we, and we kid ourselves and say that we're covering public safety, but if we were really covering public safety, we would be delivering to our audience the type of statistics that we're talking about here, right? Like what makes you vulnerable to getting shot, right? One of the things is actually having a gun in your house. Another thing is having family members that have a gun, right? I don't even know, I'm not an expert on this, but these statistics are known. And if people understood more about what truly made them vulnerable to violence, And I think that those stories would be consumed. They're much harder to do, and they don't have nearly the initial drama to them. But if we could shift and start to do those stories more, I think the public then would come to expect that they would routinely get that information out of their news media, and they would develop a habit fairly quickly. Instead, what they get is a story that makes them afraid, and then they come back for more fear. But it doesn't necessarily help them live their lives better.
Thank you so much, media ethicist and NPR public editor Kelly McBride and Dr. Kaufman. Thank you for joining us as well.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.